name is Ari Onis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. I am joined this week by Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of the Auburn Seminary. We discuss women within the multifaith movement, the future issues that will be most important for this movement, and the work she does every day at the Auburn Seminary. Thank you for tuning in to Multifaithful, and out of this week's conversation. So I am here today with Dr. Reverend Catherine Henderson, the president of the Auburn Seminary, and one of our students, Brian Young. Brian, you mind introducing yourself very quickly?
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm currently a sophomore in the College of Arts and Sciences, and I've been involved with GSL for, I guess, coming up on a year now, as both a student worker and a fellow, and also a member of the Multifaith Advisory Council. And yeah.
Great. So, Catherine, I know that I know what Auburn does very well, and I think a lot of people who are into social justice, religion, know Auburn quite well. Yeah. But maybe for those people who aren't as familiar with Auburn or who have heard of Auburn as a Christian seminary of sorts in the city and don't know the multi-faith and the social justice angle, maybe you could give some context to people for what exactly it is that Auburn does, and especially given I know in the last few years there's been a lot of revisioning of Auburn.
Yeah. So Auburn is a almost 200-year-old traditionally Christian institution founded in upstate New York in 1818 to train ministers hardy enough for the frontier, which is a phrase that we really like because there are new frontiers today, and it still takes leaders who are resilient enough and hardy enough to work on new frontiers, one of them obviously being this multi-faith world that we live in. So Auburn, for over 100 years, trained ministers, was always an open kind of institution working on progressive social issues and also fighting the fundamentalisms that threatened to take over the church in that part of the world back in the last century. And so some of those early seeds of around fighting for the abolition of slavery, fighting for prisoners' rights, children's rights, educating women early, African Americans early on, all of those were seeds that are still bearing fruit in some ways today in terms of shaping who we are. When the Depression hit hard in the 30s, Auburn moved to New York City and decided to let other seminaries do the work of training ministers, and we would do the work of leadership development and eventually research that other places were not doing. And so we're today a multi-faith leadership development and research institute that equips leaders to build multi-faith movements for justice. So that's the work. So to build communities, bridge divides, pursue justice, and heal the world. That's the kind of language that we use now. And over 20 years ago, Auburn began this journey, realizing and really assessing, you know, what could an old, venerable Christian institution do to meet the needs of a changing world. And so well before, you know, 9/11, when lots of people got interested in Islam and this growing religious pluralism, we were at work at that point, even thinking about how we're going to live together as people from different religious traditions in an ever changing and in some ways more ever more violent world where religion is often at the source of, or perverted kind of religion is at the source of so much violence and stress.
Yeah, I find it's so interesting to me how Auburn has like made that transition from being kind of a Christian institution to one that it focuses so much on multi-faith now. Because I remember in college I was I interned for the Auburn Seminary in the Center for Multi-Faith Education. Yeah. And I remember when I was first connected and doing research on Auburn, I was like, how is it that there's a Center for Multi-Faith Education in a Christian seminary that has a Reform rabbi who runs the center? Found the whole thing very confusing.
Yeah.
But it once you were here, it made a lot of sense. It was really powerful to watch.
Yeah. I mean, when we first started doing this work, the term was interfaith, and so that suggested, you know, Christian-Jewish relations, but a much more narrow frame. And we started using, you know, probably 15 or more years ago, the term multi-faith, because that suggested a broader, just a broader scope of religious traditions that we were relating to, and that for us the multi-faith word is not a sort of syncretism of a kind of blending of traditions and winnowing down to a least common denominator. That's not what we have in mind. It's really working to glean and capture and talk about the distinctiveness of our religious traditions and, you know, how they can speak to each other and speak into the world that where there's so much need. And so, you know, what are the shared values that these traditions have, but what are their distinctive qualities? Distinctive in practice, distinctive in worldview, and distinctive in ritual, and also, you know, how are they going to, what's the work they're going to do in the world?
Yeah.
And the adherence, you know, how is the world going to be different? Because for me, and I think for a lot of people of faith, we're very interested in the work that we're going to do,
yeah,
you know, to heal and repair the world. And what's the work we're going to do together with people of many faith traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our work and focus.
Yeah.
But it's been a very gradual transition from, and a conscious transition from being a Christian institution with multi-faith commitments to being a multi-faith institution with Christian roots.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's very interesting what you were saying about, you know, not negotiating, boiling down to one thing that's the same, because I think that's a mentality that, you know, not to, you know, be dictatorial, but that, you know, we need to bring more into not only multi-faith and interfaith dialogue, but also to other issues in the world, because, you know, we face so many things that differentiate all of us, and we often talk about, you know, finding, like, this common humanity.
Yes.
But we were just talking to Zenju, a Buddhist priest, the other week, and she was saying, she talks about this multiplicity of oneness, which is that, you know, we don't necessarily need to seek for what, you know, joins us together, but we need to learn how to exist in a space where we're
that's
all different.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I think that from my tradition, and I thought a lot about this in the moment of Pope Francis's visit, which was such a great multi-faith moment, really. As Pope Francis rightly noted, not just a religious moment, but he welcomed people of no faith tradition too. He found a way to be completely inclusive, distinctive and yet inclusive. And there's a phrase in my tradition in the Christian sacred text that talks about love that doesn't insist on its own way. And I think that Pope Francis embodies that, but I think that's the sort of religious quest now for a more inclusive kind of multi-faith perspective and religious perspective. It's to embody love that doesn't insist on its own way of doctrine, its own way of practice. It's the kind of thing that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks would say, you know, God loves difference. God created
the dignity
difference.
Of difference.
And so at last must we love difference too.
Right. It's really interesting you talk about Pope Francis, because actually as we've started doing interviews for this podcast, he's come up numerous times as someone who people really admire, and from a pretty wide range of spectrums. That actually leads me to almost a question in the inverse, which is I feel like so often the leaders in interfaith spaces or in faith spaces are men. Mm-hmm. And as a man, I am very familiar with seeing other men on the stage. But my boss is a woman, mm-hmm. and I think I have the good fortune of working with a lot of brilliant and powerful women who work in this space. And I'm curious, as someone who mm-hmm. Is both a woman and who talks often about women's issues or the necessity of including women more, can you talk about how, can you evaluate how we're doing in the interfaith space?
Absolutely.
How to get more women involved? What can we be doing better to include more women in our conversations?
Yeah. So I am actually an ordained Presbyterian minister and the president of Auburn, because in a moment where I was in a profound, religious sort of atheist moment mm-hmm. in college, where I really had left the faith of my childhood, it was a Catholic priest at the door of a monastery in Germany who welcomed me back in. I asked him if I could take communion since I wasn't Catholic, wanting him to say, absolutely not. And he could have said that from his perspective, mm-hmm. particularly at that time in the 70s. I mean, he could have rightly said, no, you're not Catholic, you can't. What he said was, if you want to, you won't be turned aside. And it was that one phrase from a stranger, from the religious other, mm-hmm. Welcoming me back in, that made all the difference. It really completely turned my path to returning to the church and eventually going to seminary with lots of questions. So I think that that sometimes they're, you know, they're very interesting openings, and obviously that priest would be very surprised that, you know, I'm a woman, an ordained woman minister. That sort of story, my story with Catholicism, carried on because my closest clergy group after seminary, right when I was ordained, was a group of a Catholic nun and Catholic priests who welcomed me in, including to preach in some of the Catholic pulpits here in this city, when women were not really, their own women were not preaching from their pulpits.
That's
and
so
I think it's, my point here is that what I see now in the multi-faith movement is that there is sometimes space for women, for example, Muslim women who may not, or Sikh women who may not have so many public spaces in which to exercise their leadership roles within their own traditions, actually have a lot of freedom in a multi-faith context, where they are often seen as the leader, the representative of their faith tradition. And so I think, you know, there are openings that this multi-faith work gives to women.
That's really interesting.
And then, obviously, there are contexts where I and other women find ourselves to be one, the only one, or one of a very few in a sea of men, because if you're getting top leaders within denominations or in religious traditions, particularly for those that don't have women clergy, women religious, you know, you can often find yourself being one of the few. And that has its opportunities, and it also has its disadvantages.
Yeah.
So I was at a Shabbat service at Central Synagogue here in the city this past Friday evening, and it was an extraordinary moment because their rabbi, Rabbi Angela Buchdahl, who is now senior rabbi at Central Synagogue, was welcoming the installation of her associate rabbi, Rabbi Stephanie Colin. The president of the congregation is Abby Pogrebin, also a woman. And
right.
So it's not that there were no men on the bima, you know, at the front of the synagogue, but that's a quite traditional space where they have made lots of room for women's leadership, and it was thrilling to be thrilling to be a part of that. And so for me, I mean, I was ordained 30 years ago.
Right.
And so, you know, I've seen a lot of change in my lifetime around gender issues.
Yeah. It's also really interesting. I come from an Orthodox Jewish home, and I find most of my observance and my friends are sort of somewhere in between a liberal Orthodox or a pretty traditional conservative bent. And I know many, many women who, in the Jewish world, who have been entering different forms of communal leadership, whether it's ordination through one denomination or a different type of ordination through another, and just watching people as they take these different roles within my Jewish context has been fascinating.
Right.
So seeing that play out in a broader context, I think, will also be really interesting to watch.
And yet, you know, there are so many cautionary tales, including seeing Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, in front of the Benghazi panel last week, where it's still okay for, let's just say, predominantly a group of men to, you know, grill a woman in the way that happened there, that was reminiscent for some of us of Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. And so a lot has changed, and a lot still needs to change.
Yeah. I think that image, the image of a highly gendered panel and a woman kind of being questioned, was one that was not lost on many of my friends on social media, my Facebook feed, my Twitter feed. It was a fact that was pointed out many, many times, and one I think it was good to pay attention to.
Yes. I think that one of the places that the religious voice now, religious voices, can play an important role is framing things from a moral perspective, bringing a faith voice, a religious voice, a multi-faith frame to the many public issues, gender being one of them, but other issues of justice. And and there are ways in which, for some matters, only a faith-based, faith-rooted justice frame brings new perspective to bear.
Yeah. So, you wanna? I was gonna say, so what are those issues?
Yeah.
Because I think at least. I know Auburn, right? Auburn's, I think, political orientation and stance to these issues is very well articulated, and I know Auburn often speaks out about LGBT issues and women's issues and human trafficking, the environment. So I'm curious, is there a set of issues today that a multi-faith coalition is uniquely poised to act on in a way that maybe without a faith component it would be harder to speak with conviction?
Yeah. So our work at Auburn is to equip leaders, and that is, so we go at our work from an equipping leaders perspective, but there are public issues that the leaders that we work with are very involved in, and I think today, if it's the issue of immigration, if it's the issue of money in politics, if it's the issue of gun violence, and as it relates to sanctity of life. All of those issues, if it's related to LGBT equality, all of those issues beg for a faith framing. You know, what does it mean that all people are created in God's image? If you really believe that, then that's going to make a big difference in how you think about immigrants and who's the stranger and who's the neighbor and who matters, who's counted. And so, you know, that's a frame. We did some work on money and politics,
mm-hmm.
and commissioned faith leaders from different faith traditions to, and we asked the question, do our faith traditions, do our sacred texts have anything to say about money and politics and how big money, you know, increasingly dilutes the power of any individual vote and what that actually means. And so our theologians, you know, came back with lots of answers. And so our document that we called Losing Faith in Our Democracy
mm-hmm.
Found its way into a congressional hearing. It was a bipartisan hearing, and Petrie and Sarbanes were the two principals, and they made the statement at the end that everybody needed to read this document because this issue of money in politics is not just a political issue, it's a moral yeah. issue too. Mm-hmm. And so I think our faith traditions have a lot to say. I also think that, you know, in the world of ISIL, in the world of, you know, of extremist voices, be they political or religious mm-hmm. or a mixture, a hybrid political, religious, it's really important for this multi-faith perspective to come to bear.
Yeah.
Because as religion can be part of the problem, it can also really be the only solution, the only antidote.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think strengthening our work is really to strengthen this this kind of middle multi-faith space.
Hmm. And I think it's also difficult because sometimes, you know, a lot of the time you do end up in discussions about, you know, what is facing our world now, especially with things like ISIS, you know, with how do you talk about something like that when so much of it is focused on the political aspect? Because, you know, I feel like Islam and religion is very much talked about, at least publicly and very popularly, as something tangential, mm-hmm. whereas it's very central. And so people either completely ignore that Islam is involved or they immediately just attack it because it just seems like it's an inherent part of this political system. Mm-hmm. So how do you negotiate between those two forces, I guess, mm-hmm. in that space? Or how do you get people to talk about the religious aspect of it, since it's mm-hmm. since it seems so often ignored?
Well, I think that one way is to enhance and augment and make more visible the faith voices, and so that's why we do media training of mm-hmm. faith leaders, Christians, Jews, Muslims, some 5,000 in the last 10 years, so that they can not just speak within the walls of their faith communities from traditional pulpits, but the media, social mm-hmm. media, radio, television, cable. I mean, all of those are pulpits, the pulpits of today. Mm-hmm. And so by helping faith leaders to find a public voice and to use those outlets in a more effective way, I mean, that's one way, I think, that you counter extremist rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is that you can show up in public for each other. Mm-hmm. And let me give you an example. We convened a group of 80 faith-based justice leaders, a very diverse group, in Atlanta the week before Charleston, the shootings mm-hmm. at Mother Emanuel Church. We happened to be focused with this group of multi-faith leaders on issues of race in America and, you know, the persistence of racism that's so divisive mm-hmm. for all of us. And so when Mother Emanuel, when the shootings happened, we were able to mobilize faith leaders to actually go and take 10,000 prayers from groups of many faith traditions and deliver them to the congregation at Mother Emanuel Church. Some of those prayers were from the Sikh community in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where a gunman had, mm-hmm. had gone into the Sikh Gurdwara and had murdered its members when they were worshiping, when they right. were at prayer. And we had been very close to that community. So we were able to knit that Sikh community together with the members of Mother Emmanuel. So that widens the circle of empathy mm-hmm. and care in a very powerful way. It makes these communities that may feel very alone and isolated and completely, completely at sea, it helps to create a more durable community, beyond your own faith tradition. And I think that's, that's very important. It means that you're standing with and for people. It's a different kind of solidarity, really, mm-hmm. In a very yeah. difficult moment. The other example that I think of is a year ago in September, we were part of the climate change march.
Yeah.
And
that was really popular. A lot of our chaplains at NYU involved as well.
I'm sure. And so, some 300,000 people, mm-hmm. some 100,000 people who identified themselves as people of faith.
Yep.
And we were all there on 8th Avenue together.
Yeah.
And
the interfaith,
conglomerate
was nice.
And for me, it's like, this is what the realm of God looks like, mm-hmm. to have all of us there together. And we had built an ark. A 28-foot wooden ark on a truck,
yeah.
pulled
yeah.
by a truck. And the idea is, we are all in this boat together. We're all Noah's now.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out this, how we're going to live on this one planet together.
I feel like the Noah imagery with rising oceans
absolutely.
And everything is a perfect biblical story.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact, so we had an imam or two on the ark, and ministers and rabbis, and the rabbis love to be on the ark, actually, in particular. And,
I'm sure.
And a number of, so people of Buddhists, Sikhs, mm-hmm. people of children, older people, we had the indigenous grandmothers, and so it was wonderful, and the humanist chaplain, Greg Epstein from Harvard, mm-hmm. decided that he wanted to be on the ark too, and so he had a sign that he held over the side as we rolled along, an atheist on the ark, and a lot of people, who are probably religiously unaffiliated on mm-hmm. the streets, really love that. I mean, it brought a yeah. smile. We handed out packages of animal crackers. So so it was, we call it an ethical spectacle. But the idea is, how do you create, and it got a lot of media attention on
yeah.
social media. So how do we create, from this multi-faith perspective, antidotes, and how do we inoculate yeah. ourselves and each other against extremism and hatred and violence, and then how do we go out and create a different kind of world together? So,
yeah, and so I'm curious then, because you've spoken passionately about a few different issues. So, mm-hmm. if maybe looking forward to the next 3-5 years, to mm-hmm. the extent that you can predict, like what are the issues that are kind of most prominent in your mind going forward, and that you want to focus on the most, and that if you were elected mm-hmm. head of the multi-faith movement that you'd want to direct all of our attention
yeah.
towards? Like, what should we be paying more attention to?
So the good news is, in this leaderful moment, some people talk about this is a leaderless moment. I think it's a leaderful moment. When you're talking about a multi-faith movement for justice, the good news is that no one person can represent everybody.
That's very true.
So it's a very, power is very distributed. Mm-hmm. And that's a really fantastic thing. And distributed not just among the old, but millennials. So it's a cross-generational mm-hmm. movement, too. So I'm really interested in leadership. I mean, that's Auburn's work. And I think that there are particular issues that need special attention right now. So income disparity, income inequality would be probably at the top of the list. How are we going to create a different kind of economic system where more people have access and to jobs and the means to create a life of human flourishing? I mean, I think mm-hmm. my religious tradition tells me that God longs for human flourishing for all God's people, and we have to figure out how to arrange our life together, economic life together, in a way that's going to allow more people to experience access to the things of necessity, like food and clothing and education and healthcare, and work, meaningful work, a place to sleep, clean water. You know, so inequality takes in all sorts of things. I think that if we don't focus on climate change, as people of faith and moral courage and others, along with others, if there's no planet, if we're not stewards of this planet in a much more vigorous way together, there won't be any other issues to focus on. So, you know, that's an all-encompassing issue, and I think Pope Francis really dealt with both of those issues, inequality, economics. And then all of the issues now around immigrant issues in Syria and the whole Middle East crisis that looms so large and affects so many people of different religious traditions. So, you know, we're at a crisis point now around Israel, Palestine, and Syria. And it really pretty much as far as the eye can see.
Yeah.
So those are some of the issues that I would focus on.
I feel like the Pope Francis, it's such an interesting moment that he came to, because for so long, I feel like religious movements or multi-faith movements, the lines were drawn around issues of like LGBT or gender, sexuality, abortion. And I feel like in a lot of ways, Pope Francis has almost reset the table and said like those issues are important, but they're at a place now that I'm not sure that's like the front lines of what we need to be talking about. And he's almost reoriented religious people towards focusing on other issues that I think for an entirely new set of people is, oh my goodness, this is so refreshing and this is so important.
That's right. He reset the frame.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I completely agree with that. And it means that we have to renew our efforts at connecting with each other around the issues and finding the shared values and the ways that we can leverage our separate activities for greater collective impact. And I think that we can. I mean, he paved the way for us. He gave us some of the language for that, including in the encyclical Laudate Si around climate change, but many other public issues. And I think that's must reading for anybody who claims to be a part of this multi-faith movement. I've seen enormous progress in what I would call the multi-faith movement for justice in the last couple of years. Two or three years ago, there might have been a question about whether there was such a movement. And I think that we can see signs of it everywhere, including, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, including the sanctuary movement around immigration, including some of the work around gun violence.
Yeah.
So it's a hopeful moment as I look around me.
Yeah. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us and for doing this interview.
Thanks for your work and for NYU's work in this area.
Listening to another episode of Multifaithful, we'd especially like to thank our guest, Dr. Reverend Catherine Henderson, for her wisdom and time today, and for then giving us a tour after this podcast was over of the amazing space at Auburn Seminary. Special thank you to Brian Young for both joining me on the podcast, as well as for editing and producing and doing everything. Thank you to Liz Suatos for the music from the Of Many film. Thank you to everyone for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please email us at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please leave us a review on iTunes and let us know what you think of the podcast. If you have any guests who you think would be excellent additions to the podcast, we have dreamed of interviewing them, and we would love to get to know them. So please send them our way. Until next week's episode, this is Ariel Ennis. Thanks for listening.